From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in a home in Brighton when a man wore a nightshirt for the first time. Now, that might sound like a strange way to start this show, but it's significant. That man's name is Peter Lovenheim, and he was wearing his neighbor's nightshirt because he was sleeping in his neighbor's bed. It's getting better, right? Well, keep listening. After a tragedy occurred in Lovenheim's neighborhood, he realized that he didn't know much about the people who lived next door or across the street or really anywhere on his block. Do you? How well do you know your neighbors? Lovenheim decided he wanted to be more connected to his neighbors, so he did what anyone would do. He asked if he could sleep over at their homes. About half of them said yes, one being a man named Lou, the owner of the nightshirt. Well, long story short, Lovenheim and Lou became friends, and Lovenheim wrote about this in his book called In the Neighborhood, The Search for a Community on an American Street, One Sleepover at a Time. So I'll ask this again. How well do you know your neighbors? Do you have conversations or just wave hello? Maybe not even that. Do you know your neighbors' names? A 2015 study reported in CityLab said that a third of Americans today say they've never interacted with the people living next door. That's a significant decline from 40 years ago, when a third of Americans hung out with their neighbors at least twice a week. So what has caused this decline in neighborliness? And what can we do to turn it around if we want to? My guests do want those statistics to change, and they'll share their ideas for building community. Joining me in studio today is Marcus Ebeneau. He's the director of Outreach Ministries at Sacred Heart Cathedral. Welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Also in studio, Yvonne Ferreira. She's the president of the Tenants Association at St. Bernard's Park. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also in studio is Brad Huber. Is it Huber?
Yeah, Huber.
There we go, Huber. And he is the roundtable leader of the
Irondequoit Neighborhood Roundtable.
Irondequoit Neighborhood Roundtable, thank you. And I know you've got stuff coming up. There are elections coming up right now.
Yeah, all kinds of big stuff.
All kinds of big stuff happening in Irondequoit, so we'll talk about that. And also joining us in studio is Peter Lovenheim. He is the author of In the Neighborhood. Thank you for being here.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. You can also join the conversation via email by emailing connections at wxxi.org. And I'm also on Twitter at mmacmedia. We want to hear from you this hour how well you know your neighbors, if you want to know them better. Or maybe you're a private person and you don't want to be more connected to your neighbors. That feedback's valuable too, so be sure to connect with us throughout the hour. Peter, I summarized the inspiration for your book in the introduction, but there's certainly a lot more to that story. Tell us what brought you to writing In the Neighborhood.
As you said, there was this tragedy on my street, and it involved a murder-suicide of a couple who had lived there with their two children for 7 years. After their sudden deaths, the children moved to another part of town to live with their grandparents. So this whole family, in essence, disappeared overnight. And what struck me about it, besides just the terrible tragedy, was that their disappearance seemed to have relatively little effect on the rest of the people on the street. And in asking around, I found that very few people knew that family. I only knew them to say hi or bye. And very few people seemed to know each other. So I asked myself the question, do I live in a real neighborhood or just in a house on a street surrounded by people whose lives are entirely separate from my own? And then in looking at some of the sociological studies about how Americans live today, I came to understand that my neighborhood was fairly typical. While there are exceptions everywhere, you can find neighbors who know each other well and have each other's back. By and large, the studies show that Americans today don't know the people closest around them. And in one study, for example, showed that the number of meaningful contacts people have with neighbors has declined 50% over the last 50 years. So I asked myself another question. In this age when we can, through social media and internet, et cetera, create and maintain community anywhere in the world with people, why is it so often we don't know the people next door? And what do we lose by living as strangers to each other?
In your book, you mentioned that you heard about how neighbors became more connected after a hurricane. Tell us that story, because According to Mark Duckelman, he's the author of The Vanishing Neighbor, there used to be a necessity to reach out and build bonds with people who lived close to us, and that was particularly true in the 1920s through the 1960s, when social tension ran high due to issues like the Great Depression, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and in your book, you discuss how neighbors came together after they experienced a hurricane.
Right, and so after the book came out, I received letters, emails from people all across the country sharing their experiences with neighbors and neighborhoods. And one of the ones that struck me, and I think I quote it in the book, there's this fella in Florida who talked about how the Hurricane Andrew struck and all the power went out. They lost air conditioning and everything else. So he said for the next 3 or 4 days, people were cooking over gas stoves in the street with their neighbors. And he recounts how he was surprised how people he'd never had talked to actually knew his name as a neighbor. And then over those 3 or 4 days, how he got to know everybody well and really enjoyed the companionship. And he ended his letter saying that after 4 days or so, the power came back, the air conditioning was working, and everyone went back in their homes. And he found himself kind of waiting for the next hurricane so he could reconnect with all the neighbors. And I received letters like that recounting people's experiences after natural disasters across the country. So in California, it might have been fires or earthquakes. You know, in the Northeast, we have our big snowstorms. But people experience the sense of community only, sadly, in response to some of these emergencies.
And that includes the murder-suicide in your neighborhood. So people are, it seems, they're being reactive. A tragedy happens, a disaster happens of some kind, they come together. And then, as you mentioned, people are dissipating again. I'll turn to the rest of our guests. Do you agree with these trends? Do you find that in communities that you're a part of, there is a decline in neighborliness? I know you're all community builders, so you don't want to see that happen. But in what you've experienced, Brad, do you agree?
I do agree. I think that the way that we look at neighborliness in the past versus the way that it is today might be a little bit different. And I think that people are more invested in some communities versus other communities. They spend more time with their families at home versus these folks out in the neighborhood. That's what led me to the spot where I'm at now. Is that when I moved to Irondequoit, I wasn't sure how I fit into the larger community. When I was a kid, I grew up in the country, and out there, everyone had their primary role, but then you were either a volunteer firefighter, or you're the scoutmaster, or you volunteered at the church. There was an additional role. And so when I got to Irondequoit, I'm searching for my additional role, which led me into this sort of neighborhood builder guy.
They call you Mr. Neighborhood, or Mr. Irondequoit. Our friends on Twitter are saying, and Andrew Brady says Mr. Irondequoit.
But a lot of people don't necessarily in that they don't want to be involved. It's just that they don't know how to be involved.
Okay. Do you feel like what you're doing with the roundtable is helping people find opportunities to become involved?
100%. When we started the roundtable, we based that off of a model that we started in Winona Woods, where we started a neighborhood association in Irondequoit, and then we tried to translate it to the rest of the town. And what we found was that people wanted to do this. They just didn't know how to do it. And what we needed to do was provide the tools and the avenues for them to get this work done. And since people had positive things to say about Winona Woods, and when we started to roll that out to the rest of the town, we did a little less than 20 additional neighborhood associations that started in Irondequoit. I think it's about 45% of the town that is now covered by a neighborhood association. So it's really been, it was just getting the right getting the message to the right people and giving them the right tools that they needed.
Yvonne, I met you at a storytelling workshop, and you do more for communities than so many people I've ever met, and you were sharing stories and opportunities that you've created. Tell us about some of the things that you're doing in Shalott.
Okay, so 2 years ago, moved into St. Bernard's apartment, and we're kind of covered by Charlotte and Maplewood neighborhoods, and found out that a lot of the elders, it's a 55 and older community, and they, mostly 70s, 80s, 90s, mobility challenged folks, found out that a lot of them were coming to the management, property management people, and getting rebuffed and not really getting heard. So we decided that we needed to form a tenants association so that we could have a stronger voice and be advocates for those that are not as fearless as some of us, the rest of us. But my whole life I've been doing, I was raised with my father and mother and everybody in Queens, New York, and my parents and family are from Trinidad. And in Trinidad, there's very little homelessness and very little unemployment because everybody takes somebody in or everybody puts somebody to work. And so we did the same thing in our block in Queens. We were the first multiracial family on a Catholic block in the 50s. And we all went to the same church, but there was not a lot of love on the block when we moved there. So my father, there was five of us kids, took us to the patriarch of the block and said, I've got five little people here with 10 hands, and they'll do anything you want them to do. And she didn't even open the door. And then my mother went over, who was a little lighter than my father, and took food. And the woman let her in and talked to her, and she said, that's my husband, and those are my kids, and they're willing to rake the grass, cut the hedges, go to the store, whatever you need. And it took us a while, but we won her over. And then after that, we asked her, do you know the people next door? And she said, oh, yeah, we all go to church together. So she introduced us around the block, and then we did the same thing on the block. So when a family had a fire in their garage, we all pitched in and helped rebuild it, like barn raising and all of that. And somebody else went out of work, and he was a contractor, so everybody on the block hired him until he got another job. Mm. So we that little block in Queens with about 30 houses endeavored to get to know each other very well. Always had block parties every summer and had cocoa caroling things in the winter, and you know, so I brought that experience with me to pretty much every place I've lived, mm-hmm. and I'm doing it there at St. Bernard's.
That's awesome. Marcus, and you're doing a lot of work with the outreach ministries at Sacred Heart Cathedral. You sent me a long list of everything you're doing. A lot of it is food-based, it seems. So how are you helping communities in that respect?
So that's the one thing that we all can agree on is that we all love to eat. So we use food as a way to really build community. A lot of our neighborhood, we either have longtime homeowners or tenants who cycle through the neighborhood every year, 2 years, 3 years, maybe at most. So there's a big disconnect between those two groups within our neighborhood, and we wanted to find ways to bring them together. So it wasn't like, oh, who are these new people down the street? It's, oh, these are my new neighbors, and let's try to build a community there. So we have a number of different things. We have a community dinner where we just invite anyone and everyone to come in, sit down with someone you don't know, and share a meal. We also have hot dog roasts and harvest festivals where we can just bring everyone in from the neighborhood. We have food. We try to bring the fire department, the police department, and other organizations that are around just so people know, like, oh, if I need help with X, Y, and Z, I can go down the street to this place. Or just letting people realize what's available to them in their neighborhood, what is around. We partner with the Maplewood Neighborhood Association as well to try to really build those relationships as much as possible. We also have a garden where it's really fun and wonderful to see the wide variety of people who come together to help produce food, and all the food gets given away at our food pantry. So I have this 80-year-old Italian woman who's right next to this 20-year-old African-American man who you never would think of them as being a pair, but seeing them work together, it's just wonderful. And you're just hearing them share stories and find things that they have together, things that they can both really enjoy. It's really a cool thing to see and really kind of start to build some community in our neighborhood.
I see the phone starting to ring with people wanting to share their stories about their neighborhoods, and we'll get to your calls in just a moment. But I want to talk about some things that our guests have mentioned, and I'll start with the word fear, because Yvonne, you said some people are afraid to speak up. And I think that ties into some people are just afraid to answer their doors. And I'll just share a personal story. I dropped off some cookies to my neighbors, or tried to, last week. I had this big bag of Tupperware containers, and I knocked on almost every door in my street. And there were a few people who invited me in, a few people who said, oh, this is lovely, thank you so much, it's nice to meet you. And then there were a handful of people who looked at me through their windows or their curtains and then walked away and didn't come to the door. And I thought to myself, what kind of society are we living in where, A, you don't want free cookies, and B, you're ignoring someone who's at your door? And it was 7 o'clock at night on a weekday. Maybe that's strange to have someone knocking on your door. And I thought to myself, what would I do? I would like to think that I would answer the door, but I thought maybe people are afraid. And I live in a very safe neighborhood with people who really like each other and respect each other. But maybe we're living in a society now where we're afraid to answer our own doors. What do all of you think? Peter, I'll start with you, because you did something similar, except you asked for a little more than, can I give you cookies?
Right. But I also didn't just say off the bat, I'd like to sleep
right.
over.
That's true.
I invited neighbors out to meet at a coffee and get
How
to know
How did they
each
react
other.
When you first showed up or asked them?
It took me a little while to figure out the best approach, but that turned out to be just an email or sometimes a phone call introducing myself, saying that I'm writing a book about how Americans live as neighbors today. We're neighbors, and I'd be interested to know your perspective of living on our street. Would you be willing to meet me at Starbucks for coffee one day and talk about that? So that's kind of how we got started. But to go to your question about why people don't answer the door, we have maybe not just one, but two complete generations now who have grown up hearing about stranger danger. And I know when I was teaching writing at RIT, I had students who, they'd learned about stranger danger since they were 5 years old. And if they saw someone on campus, particularly an adult who they didn't know, they were far more likely to think of that person as a threat than as a potential friend. And I think this is a pervasive problem in society where people have actually been taught, and I think unjustifiably, to be afraid of each other.
I want to listen to a clip in just a moment, which I think describes that very well, Peter. And it's pretty cheeky. It's by a comedian. But before we hear that, let's go to the phones, because Josh in Rochester has a story to share about his neighborhood. Go ahead, Josh.
Hi, thanks so much for having this conversation. I really appreciate it. I'm a homeowner in the Swilberg neighborhood. I've been there with my wife for about 13, 14 years, which is a small little 20-block neighborhood. Most people lump us in with the South Wedge. I actually, it's funny, I grew up in New Orleans, so these stories about hurricanes certainly resonate as a child growing up and losing power for 2 weeks. That'll kind of change your perspective about neighborliness. But I guess your story just really broke my heart about not opening your doors for neighbors. I think from my porch, I can probably count a dozen neighbors as good friends. We joke that when we go out of town, it's hard choosing who's going to look after our cat. And I guess one of my, great stories is my wife and I got bucket list tickets to go see Paul McCartney in Toronto for our wedding anniversary. And we were excited. And I got a call about an hour before the show from my neighbor, who's a retired RG&E man. And he said, don't want you to worry. The transformer outside your house blew and put a surge through your house. But I went through everything. Wiring's fine. You have nothing to worry about. You can take care of it. Enjoy the concert. And that's just kind of the neighborhood that we live in. And I think, part of it is we had a genesis where our community had to come together about 30 years ago to fight off a expressway expansion, paving literally right through the middle of it. And we were successful in that fight. But I think it's partly that. It's partly that our houses are close together. And it's partly that I think there's just a critical mass of people who value community in our neighborhood. So we do simple things like our neighborhood, our commercial avenue is South Clinton. So we're fortunate to have a number of restaurants. Just once a month, informally, we'll throw up a post on social media and pick a restaurant, pick a slow night. We'll all kind of show up and get dinner. And hang out, and we have small events, but we're all really busy and we've busy lives, so we try to keep things pretty simple. But we all really value that sense of community. So I guess I live in a bubble, and I'm really fortunate that way. But I think it's really important that that people know their neighbors and get to know the people that they share driveways with and share a street with.
Josh, if a neighbor knocked on your door, one that you didn't recognize, just looking out the window, how would you react?
Oh, I mean, no problem. I open my door all the time. There are kids selling any number of things or soliciting signatures for being on the ballot for an election. In the summer, we keep our storm door screen open, and we're certainly not the only neighborhoods like that. I'd have no problem answering the door. I know there's a lot of, like you said, stranger danger, a whole lot of media that assaults people. But the reality is, no one's really coming into your house and harming you. The chance of that happening is so exceptionally small that it seems like to trade a tiny bit of, perceived security and safety for a life of isolation seems like a really awful trade.
Well, thanks, Josh, for calling and sharing all that with us. And I love your story. Unfortunately, I think you might be in the minority when it comes to door knocking. So let's listen to this clip. Again, this is by a comedian. This is Sebastian Maniscalco. Many of you may have heard this before, but here he is doing a bit about doorbells and neighbors.
I was sitting in my house a couple weeks ago, just relaxing. My doorbell rang. This is weird. It's a different feeling when your doorbell rings today opposed to 20 years ago, right? 20 years ago, your doorbell rang. That was a happy moment in your house. It's called company. You'd be sitting there on a Thursday night watching TV. Your doorbell rang. The whole family shot off the couch. Oh, my God! Put the lights on. Somebody's here. We got people. The whole family went to the door. The kids were in socks. They slid up to the door. Nobody looked to see who it was. Right? You just opened up the door. You were like, oh, my God, look at that. Look at us here. And you'd ask them, what the hell are you doing here? And the person would be like, I was in the neighborhood. I thought I might stop by, see how the kids are doing. They're like, oh, come on in. We're going to have some cake. Now your doorbell rings? It's like, what the f***? Right, your own mother's crawling across the kitchen floor. Get down, my army crawl. Army crawl, get in the closet. Go get the sword in the living room. Somebody get the sword underneath the couch in the living room. There's a sword. All right, you have to turn and ask your family. You invite anybody over? You invite anybody over? You can't stop by anybody's house anymore. If you do, you have to call from the driveway. You're like, I'm here. Can I approach?
So that's Sebastian Maniscalco, a comedian. Brad, I'll start with you. What do you think about that bit? Is that true of society today?
In some ways, yes. But I think that Josh's phone call really highlights an important message, and that is the way that communities are built today. So Josh is talking about his neighborhood in Swilberg, which is built a long time ago. I know that many neighbors, maybe houses in Swilberg, don't even have driveways. And he doesn't have air conditioning, so he has to leave his door open. And he has a front porch on his house. And so if a neighbor were to knock on Josh's door, 9 times out of 10, he's already seen that person in his neighborhood because of the proximity in which he lives to that person. Jane Jacobs, talks about this in her book about the chance encounter, and that the way that old communities were built, you bumped into people in the neighborhood probably before you knocked on their door and asked them to do something. Today we get in our car. If your car is attached to your house, you might not actually step foot outside of a bubble, out of the house, to the garage, to the car, to the work, to the house, for a very long time. So I think that his story really highlights the importance of shared space and the way that communities are developed in order to foster strong relationships between neighbors.
That's so true and so important, especially what you mentioned about the front porch, because the front porch is making a comeback. In the middle of the 20th century, they were less needed and less cool, I guess you could say, because people wanted to be inside. They had air conditioning. They wanted to watch TV. But as of this year, front porches being built on houses is up 23% from two decades ago, and that number keeps rising. So the percentage grew from 42% in 1994 to 52% in 2004, and then 65% last year. And it's mostly young people, according to this data. Younger urbanites, they think porches look like stages. They're opportunities to tell stories, throw concerts, foster community building, stop for wine sense is something that it's called. What do you all think about the front porch? Do any of you have a front porch?
Well, good. I moved here in 2007. My brother, he has a house in 19th Ward, and I love that community because we have a big front porch. And in the summertime, they have host an event at your front porch. So I'm a storyteller. So on our porch, we said, okay, this Saturday, storytelling 2 o'clock, and people just come, bring their lawn chairs, sit on the grass, and we had at it, passed out lemonade. Other people have an art show, or they have their son play music all over the 19th Ward, and you just look in the calendar and see what. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And plus, just sitting outside and watching the world go by. I mean, you know, it's a great thing to do.
I'd like to mention something about this notion of chance encounter.
Yeah.
Because it's an important concept, and certainly a front porch and a neighborhood where houses are closer to the street and there's sidewalks and people are out walking creates the opportunity for that. And it may be true, as you point out, that younger people find this more appealing. However, I've been living part of the year recently in Washington, D.C., and in an urban area that is heavily populated by younger people, mostly in their 20s and 30s. And what I am seeing is that while people are out on the street and walking, they are more and more often removing themselves from the public sphere by walking around wearing earbuds and staring at their phone screens. So while they're technically in public space, they are removing themselves from that space and eliminating the possibility of the chance encounter, which is something that creates community. So this is a counter trend, I suppose, that maybe we need to pay some attention to.
That's a great point. We have all this technology that helps connect us better, but it actually isolates us in so many ways. You're right. Marcus, what do you think about that aspect, the technology piece?
I find it really interesting because last weekend I went to get my hair cut, and I was sitting there waiting, and every single person had their phone out staring at it. This was out in Webster, just kind of a chain place, and where people are a little better well-to-do. But when I think about other places where people just kind of sit and wait, I think about our food pantry, and there where people are sitting there and talking to each other. Just whoever's sitting down next to you, you strike up a conversation, and it's really interesting to see friendships and just connections being made organically, which we don't see as much, especially I feel like with younger generations where we go on our phone and I can talk to my friends in Alaska without even thinking about, you know, who's sitting down next to me, where I could have a new best friend next to me, but I just have no idea what's there. But I think with all the positive things that technology can bring, it really can be a drawback in a lot of ways as well of missing what's right there next to you. Mm-hmm.
Listeners, I'm starting to see the phone ring. Your questions and comments are coming in via email, so we will get to those in just a few minutes because I'm late for my only break of the hour. So we'll take that short break. When we come back, some of your comments and then also some ways that we can use technology to better connect ourselves and also do it within the neighborhood. So we're outside and we're talking to each other, even using that technology. So taking it one step farther. So let's take our only break of the hour. More connections next. Coming up in our second hour, we continue a connections tradition by talking about new words added to the dictionary this year. Maybe you're a normie. You don't know a lot of these new words. That's okay. We're going to take a quiz and test some of your knowledge along with our guest knowledge, and we'll do some learning in the process. Feeling nervous? That's okay. Just text a shruggy to your friends. New words in the dictionary, coming up next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Megan Max, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the decline in neighborliness, and that's tied to some recent data and statistics, and also some personal experiences that I've had, that our guests have had, that you have had, that we're hearing about. And I know I mentioned toward the top of the hour that I dropped off cookies to my neighbors. Some didn't come to the door, and I don't want to be disparaging of my whole neighborhood. I just want to say I have the best next-door neighbors in the history of next-door neighbors. So shout out to Chris and Corey, who are two of my great friends. And then I also wanted to share, I got a card from a neighbor who was hesitant to come to the door at first, and she finally did. And in this note, she's an older woman. I won't say much about her life story, but she says, "I really miss the neighborliness that our neighborhood used to have. She grew up in the house that she lives in now. She moved away. She moved back into that childhood home. And she says, I really appreciate people like you stopping by because I want to build that back up. I want to feel like we felt before." So it's not all bad, listeners. There's hope. My guests this hour are Marcus Ivanov. He's the Director of Outreach Ministries at Sacred Heart Cathedral. Yvonne Ferreira is the President of the Tenants Association at St. Bernard's Park. Bradley Huber is the leader of the Irondequoit Roundtable. And Peter Lovenheim is the author of the book In the Neighborhood. And Peter, we'll start things off. There's an email for you from one of your neighbors. This is from Ellen. And she says, "Hi, Peter Lovenheim. I'm in the car right now and caught this program. You know me. I live near you. I rarely see my neighbors. I met one last summer who likes to sit out front, but she's moving. So nothing much has changed. As you know, there are not many homes that have front porches in our neighborhood designed that way for a reason. Loved your book. Please stop by and say hello or autograph it sometimes."
Okay.
So there's Ellen.
It's a nice invitation.
I would think that you writing a book about your neighborhood and after sleeping over at your neighbor's homes, maybe there would be more community in your neighborhood. But according to Ellen, it sounds like people are still...
Well, I'm not sure exactly where she lives in the neighborhood, but there actually have been some positive developments on my street. We have a nice annual picnic now. And this past fall, one of the relatively recent newcomers to the street hosted an event on a Sunday afternoon for all the families with small kids, and they could make apple cider together. He had all these barrels of apples, and the kids were taught how to crush the apples and make cider. So that was a really nice event.
That's awesome. We'll turn to the phones now. This is Ryan from Geneva. Go ahead, Ryan.
Hi, thanks for having me on. We're building a sustainable, it's called the Solar Village in Geneva. And actually, I wanted to just, as you're hearing this great discussion, wanted to comment that I think we need to be holding developers more to task for building spaces or when they're renovating spaces to encourage community. I know for our part, it was not the most profitable thing to add a village house for a gathering space or a place for people to come together and see each other even when they're getting the mail. But it was kind of the right thing to do for the development, and I just wondered if the panel had any thoughts on getting municipalities to actually require developers to include community spaces more beyond, you know, just some, you know, little bit of landscaping, but actual gathering spaces.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks for that comment. We'll start with you, Marcus. What do you think?
I think it'd be a wonderful idea. I haven't heard of any organizations that are pushing for that, but I think the town square that we used to have back in when cities were smaller and areas were smaller, that was a place where everyone could go and really build that community and have that shared experience. I think when we talk about natural disasters and things like that, it's that shared experience that brings us together. And a lot of times our communities are lacking that shared experience that we can say, oh yeah, remember that time we were all together and we all did X, Y, and Z. And it'd be really great to talk to developers to make that a priority.
Mm-hmm. Yvonne, what do you think?
Well, we have a community room that used to be the chapel at St. Bernard's Park. We have big challenges getting our neighbors to come out of their apartments to come and join us. So we offer food and movies and storytelling. So in November 19th was International Family Storytelling Day. It's called Telebration, and I hosted it. And more people came out than I expected, which was awesome. And it's just a simple thing. And I offered dinner, so it was turkey, chili. And we sit around and just tell a family tale, like you used to do at a table. But we made a big circle to do that. And then we went and had dinner to talk some more and get to know people more. So I think it's very important to have a community space. Our elders didn't want to open the door much for anybody because their peepholes were too high. So we had the management people put them lower so they could look out. We are in a pretty secure building. It's coded to get in, but sometimes people get in and do not so nice things. So people are a little timid, but we encourage them to say, "Who are you? Who's out there?" And we say our names and we say who we are. You know, so I think communication through the doorbell ringing and friendliness, you know, it helps that.
Mm-hmm. Brad, you live in a town that has a lot of green space. Do you find that having those spaces helps build community?
Well, it's a challenge in the suburbs because our neighborhoods do not have the shared spaces that the city neighborhoods do. In our entire neighborhood, there is no one single public shared space. What we have seen in recent years is the development of I-Square, where a lot of people in Irondequoit, they've done such great work bringing the community together, and when people want to talk about a place to go, that's where they go, or they go to the new library. Problem is that it's not necessarily in a walkable distance for a lot of us, and we want those spaces to be accessible to as much of the community as possible. And that's why it's important to have a small pocket parks or areas like that. However, I don't necessarily think that the entire idea of a neighborliness needs to be built on shared space. It's certainly a component of that. However, the idea of not necessarily being so self-sufficient. Today, every household seems to be so entirely self-sufficient. They need a ladder, they go to Lowe's and they buy a ladder. They need some type of tool, they order it off of Amazon and it comes in 2 days. Well, it seems like we used to borrow a lot of those things from neighbors. And now it's just, especially in neighborhoods who have the means, easier for people to just purchase things than it is for people to share.
Mm-hmm. That's such a good point. Peter, I know you wanted to jump in.
No, I mean, if your neighborhood doesn't have public space, one little thing you can do to create a little opportunity to meet neighbors. Next spring, instead of planting flowers and vegetables in the backyard, if you plant them in the front yard, that puts you out there with some regularity. And then as other people walk by, you can have a conversation, and that can create a little sense of public space, even if there isn't any official.
That's a great idea. We have an email here that says we're being too optimistic. So this is from MJ. She says, "I feel as if your show is somewhat optimistic about people. I wish I could feel that way lately. My neighborhood has deteriorated into petty squabbles. People I've known and have had over for dinner at my own house now snub each other at neighbors' funerals. They talk about each other. I find it extremely disconcerting and depressing. It seems like a byproduct of our snarky, argumentatively charged, I'm always right kind of culture. These are the same people I've known for 20 years, yet I hardly recognize them anymore."
When you have a neighborhood Facebook page, you see a lot of that sort of thing. The Facebook page has been really positive and very negative in that people can say whatever they want, however they want, whenever they want, without much thinking about it. When we first started the group, we spent a lot of our time kind of managing comments and things of that nature on the Facebook group. It essentially became like the front porch of a general store where you would just hear everybody talk about anything. But as a teacher, I know that starting the year with strong norms is really important. And so spending a lot of times in that first couple of years norming the group and saying what types of expectations we have for our community, because this is a reflection of our community, the things that people are going to see posted here. And, you know, just five simple guidelines for posting on that page. And, you know, number one was, this is for talking with neighbors, and it is not for talking about neighbors. That's been sort of the golden rule there. And what I think people have come to understand is that we may not agree about everything, but we all share this space here together, and we all want the best for our community. And so here we'll talk about those things.
That's great.
Yeah, we have a neighborhood newsletter. Got so many things we couldn't print. And so we said, okay, we gave them back and said, if you can find a way to make this more positive, we'd be happy to put it in here. We have different puzzle room areas and lots of lounges all over the place because it's a historical building. They couldn't put apartments everywhere. They had to leave some space. So we have a bunch of little cliques that go here and talk about this. But we just, when they come to the meetings, we say, you have 5 minutes, and it's got to be positive. So, you know, you don't have to like everybody. You can't like everybody. You're just different people. So just accept the fact that when we're together, we're building community. We're going forward and doing positive things.
Mm-hmm. Have any of you heard of the Nextdoor app?
Yeah. Yes.
So that just tying into what we were talking about earlier about technology, although we're more connected with technology, sometimes it can isolate us a little more. But I thought this Nextdoor app was pretty effective. Marcus, what do you think? Describe it a little for us, for those who may not know.
So I actually get it in the email. I don't use the app. It's kind of a sounding board for the neighborhood. So if there's a lost pet, people say, hey, I found this Cocker Spaniel on this street at this time. Is it yours? It's also, you know, my mailbox was knocked down. Did anyone see anything? Or, you know, we're going to have this event at this place on a different day. And there's a wide variety of things. Oftentimes I learn about people and events that are happening one street, two streets over from me that I had no idea was happening. And it's really helpful just to be like, oh, wow, look at all these wonderful things. Or sometimes, oh, these are kind of critical issues that we need to come together as a community to address. I think, like, same thing with Facebook. It has its positives and negatives, where people can be somewhat anonymous, but people also know where you live when you post. So that kind of keeps things a little more civil and keeps people accountable.
Mm-hmm. Up next on the phones is Peter in Rochester. Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Hi. I live down at the Park Barrington neighborhood, and we're an extremely tight neighborhood. I had a situation in September where a gentleman broke into my house on Labor Day, 8 o'clock right on my front porch. And, you know, this is what it is down here at the city. You have those kind of situations. I think it's naive, given the world we live in now, to turn your back and not be vigilant in that. And this is what our neighborhood accepts. And we anticipate it, and we look out for each other, and there's an email, all kinds of things, and we thrive. But we accept that our neighborhood is targeted. People are coming down casing our stuff all the time. And like I said, I came home Labor Day, and there was a gentleman who had gotten on February, served 4 years for rape. I had physical confrontation with him in my own home. Luckily, the police response was fantastic. And he just got another 4 years. The ADA pushed him through with lightning speed, cutting a deal. So, you know, it's important for everybody to know that talk about community and the people that are in charge of our public safety, I'm not quite sure that they're doing their best with all that. But down here, we're looking out for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And
nice.
It's all you can do. And 99% of the people are trying to get by, enjoy their time, be part of a community, and do the right thing. It's the 1%.
Right.
And they get all the attention and make it bad. But we're loving it down here. But that's, don't ever turn your back or get soft, because that's the game that's going on. People are looking at my stuff going, I hope you turn your back because I want it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a reality.
Right.
So,
and Peter, you raised some good points about how city officials or police, or they can better understand neighborhoods and some of the issues there and what they can do to try to curb some of the issues. And I think you're absolutely right. There's, you know, a few incidents. This came up at the workshop Yvonne and I were at a few weeks ago, where there are one or two incidents in a neighborhood, and it characterizes the nature of that whole neighborhood. And, you know, we're living in a time, and a lot of this is the media, where sometimes that's really unfair. But I really like that your neighbors are sticking together, and thank you for sharing that story. Up next on the phone is Candace in Rochester. Hi, Candace.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Go ahead.
So first I wanted to speak a little bit to the idea of what was mentioned earlier with cell phones in public and isolating us. And especially with younger people, I really wanted to stress what you had said earlier about stranger danger. Like, I know that myself and a lot of people my age, we tend to try to purposely isolate ourselves, like having headphones in just to deter people from talking to us, because a lot of us are afraid of that random person on the street trying to talk to us and possibly trying to harm us. And it's something that my friends and I were actually just talking about the other day, so it's amusing that you guys are all talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, I wanted to kind of talk about the idea of busyness as a difficulty in kind of creating a neighborly connection. I grew up in a town in Massachusetts, and when we were, like, when all the kids were younger, we were all really close, and as we got older, like into middle school and high school, the entire neighborhood seemed to kind of fall apart. Like, the kids were kind of holding it together. And now that I'm older and living in an apartment complex with people around my age, all of us have very different schedules. And while we might pass each other and say, oh, we should probably get to know each other, like, I work late nights, they work early mornings. And because we never get to see each other, no one really knows one another. And we're all kind of nervous about, like, even opening our doors if someone knocks and says, hey, you have a package out front of your door, just so you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, Candace, you gave us a lot to think about. We're down to our last couple minutes, so I want to talk about one point you mentioned specifically. People just don't have time. And I think if we do want to be better connected to our neighbors, we have to make a conscious choice to spend whatever time or social capital we have to doing that. Peter, what do you think?
I certainly agree with you. I don't think it takes that much time, though, just to have a, you know, occasional friendly conversation with somebody who lives nearby, shares the same physical space essentially with you.
That's true. What would you recommend? Say you're living in a neighborhood, you're hearing this show, you're thinking, I want to do better, I want to do more. What's your top recommendation?
Well, gosh, I would just be bold and go ring the doorbell, even without cookies, you know, and just introduce yourself. My experience of talking on this topic across the nation for several years now is that, you know, 9 out of 10 people feel isolated, and they also are looking for connections. Not to be best friends, but simply to know and be known among the people they live with. So I think if you took the bold move and rang the doorbell, chances are very good you'd be welcomed.
That's awesome. Go ahead.
So what I do, I always do, I'm from New York City, you won't believe this, I speak to everybody. I don't care who they look like, what they look like. I make them put their phones away. Hello, hi there, and make them speak back. My niece thinks I'm crazy. She hates to walk down the street with me. But I do it in the apartment complex also and encourage our neighbors to do that. Just when we see them passing at the mailbox or going to the laundry, and then when we haven't seen neighbors for a while, we just go knock on their door. Mm. You're all right? You want to come out? You don't want to come out? We're having Carolyn. You want to sign up? We'll come visit if you don't want to sing, but, you know. So I think it's important to speak to people when you see them and greet them. It's a simple thing. You know, they're getting in their car, say, hey, have a nice day, wave across the street, you know. I think that would make more friendly neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Brad, what about you? Top recommendation.
Top recommendation is to love where you live. I think back to Peter's story, and he's, you know, upset that something has happened about where he lived to his personal space. But for some reason, he stays there. Why does he stay? Well, my guess would be that he really loves the Park Avenue neighborhood. You know, when I think of Park Avenue, I can tell you a million things about it, and I bet he could tell you even more things about it. So if you know a lot about where you live, when bad things happen, you have a sense of identity of this place that has been built amongst you and your neighbors, and really makes it to thwart anything bad that could happen. So if you start to love where you live, you get to know it intimately, and you get to meet people where they are, rather than trying to get people to come to you. What are they doing already? And oh, you know, every block's got a boss. You got to find the boss person of the block.
The patriarch.
Yeah.
Ray Ray via email says block parties. He recommends those for neighborhoods. Marcus, you get the last word. What's your recommendation?
I guess I would say assume the best from people. Don't assume that they're out to get you or swindle you. Doesn't mean you have to be naive, but recognizing, give people the benefit of the doubt and really see where that takes you.
Well, thank you to all of my guests for being here today and being neighborly, and all of you who called in and shared your stories. Thanks to Marcus Ibano, Yvonne Ferreira, Bradley Huber, and Peter Lovenheim for all of your thoughts. You can check out Peter's book. It's called In the Neighborhood. And you have a new book coming out soon. Super quick, what's the title?
The title is The Attachment Effect.
All right. Well, we'll have you back in to talk about that,
too.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Stay with us. Next hour, we're taking a quiz, so go get a pen. Talk to you soon.